Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. William F. Miller, the world's premier authority and visionary on business strategy, innovation, technology, entrepreneurship, industrial development, and international thought leadership. Bill, you bring a substantive history of significant and considerable international contribution to business, industry, governments, engineering, computing science, innovation, education, society, the public good, and entrepreneurship to this interview. We are very fortunate to have you come in today to share your many deep experiences with our audience. Thank you.
Well, Stephen, thank you. I'm happy to do this interview. All those glowing things you just said, it makes me think I'd like to meet that guy, but at any rate, I hope you've not overstated it too much.
Well, Bill, can you profile your work on industrial development with special interest in local and regional industrial development, and then the evolution of regions of innovation and entrepreneurship, and the concepts of habitat for entrepreneurship, and the globalization of R&D, and then what are your predictions?
Yes, this has been an interest of mine for some time, studying the local developments. Many people are interested in international and national developments. Of course, local becomes international very quickly, but drilling down and looking at what works at the local level has been an interest for perhaps the last 20 years. There are basically three ways to get economic growth. One is through improving the factor inputs, improving the quality and the quantity of land, labor, capital, and so forth. The second is through trade and comparative advantage, specialization. And third is through innovation and entrepreneurship. And for developed countries and in rapidly developing countries, the latter becomes very important. So this has become the focus of my interest, academic interest, for perhaps the last 20 years. We have studied in my various projects local regions in the United States and other countries, heavily in Asia, although I'm familiar with some of the developments in Europe. Our most intense studies have been with Asian countries.
So you're speaking about Asian countries then. So what can you say about the future of these countries such as Japan and Korea, China, Taiwan, and Malaysia?
Well, those countries, I think, are doing quite well. There are ups and downs in the global economy, but they are all very technology-oriented countries now. They've been very much export-oriented. I think it is very important now, and China recognizes this, that they have to become more dependent upon domestic growth and less on exports, and they're taking actions to move in that direction. And you see a lot of that domestic growth. I was just in China recently, and you see so many automobiles on the street. I remember the days 34 years ago when the streets were full of bicycles. It's very hard to find a bicycle now in China, although I'm sure they are, and I saw a few long sidewalks, but the streets are full of automobiles. That's a domestic demand, which has been rising very rapidly there. All of those countries have their own areas of specialization. Japan and Korea, of course, are small compared with China in population, although Japan, in terms of GDP growth, still exceeds that of China. Taiwan is also relatively small. Malaysia is about the same size as Korea. In trying to move up the value-added scale, as all of them are trying to do, one of the most essential things is the quality of their educational institutions. And I think that's the biggest problem for most of the Asian countries. Japan and Korea have a few outstanding universities, but the other countries do not have yet outstanding universities. They're all focusing on that, but I think there's a lot of reform that will be needed in order for those universities to become really outstanding universities.
I see. I'm just thinking of China and Tsinghua University. Do you think that they're almost there? Or?
I think they've got a long ways to go. Part of it has to do with what they teach and how they teach, and part of it has to do with structural forms, governance, and so forth. I think they are making the right progress, but it takes a long time to build a strong institution, and the structure of it has a lot to do with it. The faculty need a lot of freedom of action, and the administrators need a lot of freedom of action, and I think at the present time they don't have that same degree of freedom of action, which I think is important for universities to be able to reform and change themselves. They need to experiment.
You know, you mentioned that Japan right now is second in GDP. Do you think that China will pass Japan this year?
Well, I don't know whether they'll do it this year. And of course, there are two different estimates of GDP. One is purchasing power parity, which, of course, because of the low cost of certain things in China, that makes them stand up higher in GDP. And the other is, of course, an exchange rate. And depending on how much you're dependent upon the international markets, exchange rate becomes very important. The actual estimates of GDP should be some mixture of those two. I think China will eventually, because it's such a big country, surpass Japan and GDP. I'm not sure how soon that will happen.
Now, can you contrast what's happening, let's say, in Asia with the countries in the European Union?
Well, the European Union is undergoing a lot of change. Also, right now, they're racked with the difficulties of their heavy debt. Unfortunately, they have very heavy debt. Of course, Japan also has very heavy debt compared to their GDP. But those European countries have to solve that problem. But at the same time, there has been a movement toward, one, reforming their universities, making them stronger. Secondly, there have been emphasis on innovation and entrepreneurship. Again, there are structural issues why it's more difficult in Europe than I think it is in Asia. They don't have the same freedom of action. Sometimes the labor laws are restrictive in Europe. Those become important issues in terms of mobility of the labor force. So they have structural problems, but you begin to see levels of entrepreneurship in different countries, particularly in the Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden. You see quite active entrepreneurship there.
So in the European Union, then, which country would you be very concerned about? I guess Greece would be one, but what are some of the others?
Well, I think all the heavy debt countries, Greece, Spain, Portugal, will have problems, but even the big countries have problems. And I noticed in the G20 meeting, there's just an agreement they're all going to try to reduce their debt, including the United States, which has to reduce its debt. So there's a balancing act between stimulus and debt reduction, but I think there has been a shift in emphasis now in the world toward debt reduction. We went through these enormous stimulus packages and incurred a lot of debt in so doing, and I think there's a realization now that we have to address the debt problem.
So that's interesting. How do you see that in relation to, let's say, China when they have so much currency reserves?
Yeah, well, China's in better shape in that regard. It's not clear to me how they've been using those currency reserves. They also had a big stimulus package, but it was clear that much of the stimulus went into areas where it wasn't particularly needed, and that created a heavy investment in real estate and has created the real estate boom, real estate bubble. They've put in place instruments to control that. For example, going forward, one can only own one apartment. You can't speculate on a second apartment. I think people who already own more than one can still continue to own them. But so to reduce the speculation, but part of it is because the stimulus went to areas and to companies that didn't particularly need it. Some did, of course, but some didn't, and as a consequence, they looked for ways to invest that money, and they invested it in real estate.
So do you think the measures taken by the government are strong enough in terms of stemming this sort of issue on the real estate side for China?
I don't know. China's been very good about handling those kind of problems in the past, and I have no reason to think they won't handle them in the future. They had huge bank debt at one time, and they managed that rather well. So I have confidence that they will manage it well. I think I don't know much beyond that.
Now, where do you see the future of North America?
Well, I think the North American economy will still be a very big economy for a long time. Our progress will depend upon new activities, and of course, there's been a huge amount of research support and stimulus in the areas of green technologies. I think the clean tech or green technologies offer really big opportunities because almost anybody can play some role in the green economy. You could either be a producer of feedstocks for biofuels, or you can work on the conservation side of building management, making more energy efficient materials. Materials such as cement. Cement now is not made in a very energy efficient way, and inventing new ways to do that, and there are people working on it to make them more energy efficient, those processes more energy efficient, I think a great opportunity. So everybody has a role there, and where you have a movement, an activity where everybody can play in some ways, I think that can create a lot of dynamism, and we're beginning to see that. Of course, here in Silicon Valley, there's been a huge emphasis on the clean tech or green technologies, and I think that that will continue here.
So can you talk about your work as co-director of the Stanford Program on Regions of Innovation and Entrepreneurship?
Yes, we've studied a number of regions, local regions around the world. We started with Silicon Valley because one of the reasons we started that was we had so many people coming and asking about Silicon Valley and how did it work. We still have that. I have 200 to 300 visitors a year. I have a group visiting me later this morning from Italy. They're very interested in, this group is from the Netherlands. They're very interested in how Silicon Valley works. So we produced a book called The Silicon Valley Edge, which was published in the year 2000. Since that time, we've had three other publications. We had one what's called Making IT, which was about the rise of Asia in IT and information technologies. We covered six Asian countries. We covered the regions. We didn't cover the whole country. We covered certain regions in six Asian countries. That was Japan and Korea. We treated China and Taiwan separately, Singapore and India. And in that, we found certain features which we think are important for an advanced high-tech entrepreneurial habitat, as we call it. By habitat, we mean the social, business, and political environment in which entrepreneurship works. And with a good habitat, you can breed entrepreneurs. We think that's quite important. And there are several aspects of that. One of the institutions that you need, or the infrastructure, if you want to think of it that way, universities and research institutes, you need the venture capital industry, you need specialized business services of lawyers, accountants, and consultants who know how to work with startup companies. Of course, you need favorable government policies on intellectual property protection, tax, labor laws that are favorable. Those are all essential institutions that have to be in place. Then there are regional dynamics that are at play. For example, the global linkages. Here in Silicon Valley, we're very fortunate because we have a large number of immigrant entrepreneurs. These immigrant entrepreneurs not only have created a lot of our companies, but they're also the ones who provide the linkages back to their home country. And innovation, particularly product innovation, doesn't occur in one place anymore. It occurs in a number of places. You have to get the best of the different components and services for your product that you can get wherever you can find them anywhere in the world. And so the global linkages become very important. And of course, quality of life is important. But there are other things which I would classify as social attitudes and practices. I don't know a better way to describe them. But these include having a results-oriented meritocracy where people know and believe that they will be rewarded for what they know and what they can do and not by who they know. You need this flexible workforce I mentioned. You need a climate that rewards risk-taking and tolerates failure. And that's a difficult one in some places. And here, the laws have an effect. There are some countries that if you go bankrupt, you cannot get financing for some fixed period of time, 5 years, sometimes for a long time. That's a heavy penalty for an entrepreneur. Here, you can fail and start over, and you can fail and start over with the same financial people, in fact. So an open business environment that encourages collaboration as well as competition, these are all more or less social attitudes and practices that are hard to replicate. It's a culture, if you like, of entrepreneurship that takes hold, and we see this is the hardest part to replicate.
So do you see other regions that have this kind of capability and or have the same sort of maturity as Silicon Valley anywhere else in the world?
I have not. We've looked at a lot. I don't see any that have all of these features. Of course, even Silicon Valley, we're stronger on some than others. But Silicon Valley has most of all of these features. I see other countries that have a large number of them, but not all of them. The Senshu Science-Based Industrial Park in Taiwan was one of the earliest ones outside the U.S. to develop. It's developed well. It has quite a large number of these. I still find them more risk-averse. And if you don't take risk, you won't be on the frontiers. Being on the frontiers means there are going to be failures. And in those cultures, they don't like failures. So they're a little more risk-averse. In the Jiangguancun Science Park in Beijing, I see a lot of similarities to Silicon Valley. I think that they also are a little more risk-averse, but that may change over time. As they get more confident, they may be willing to take greater risks.
You know, you indicated that you have a number of visitors in the hundreds that come to this program to have a look. Are they governments or are they regions?
Well, that's a good question. We have people from all aspects. We have some people from government, usually local governments. We have people from universities that are interested in how their universities might change, and they're very interested in Stanford and Silicon Valley, how Stanford interacted with Silicon Valley. We have people from a business that are interested in understanding how businesses work here and how startups start. So we have all of the above in these visits. Recently, the president of Russia announced that they were going to develop a Silicon Valley in one of the suburbs outskirts of Moscow. And we've now had quite a number of Russians coming to talk to us about Silicon Valley and how it works. So these come and go depending on various government initiatives. But a lot of it comes from the universities. Universities are very interested in Stanford and its historical interaction with Silicon Valley.
Neil, can you talk further about your work as co-director of the Stanford Executive Education Strategic Uses of Information Technology?
Well, those are two different programs. The program on the regions of innovation and entrepreneurship. Let me talk about the second in a moment, the Stanford Executive Education Program on Strategic Uses of Information Technology. That's a program that has now terminated. We ran it for about 12 years. That was focusing on how companies use technology as part of their growth strategy. We used a lot of cases of companies, the eBay case. We also spoke a lot about open innovation as a trend. I wouldn't say it's a fully established trend, but a movement in the direction of open innovation and companies that practice that. It was aimed toward the middle-level executive, an upper-level executive, maybe not the CEO, although we did have CEOs coming. Usually it would be the person who would be responsible for the planning or the heads of divisions who would have a heavy responsibility in the companies. those are the people who attended. And it's quite a successful program for quite a large number of years. By the time we had taught so many people, I think the enrollments were beginning to go down a little bit because we had reached about as far as we could reach. So, and that's very common of our executive education programs. You run them for quite a number of years, and then you find that time to move on to something else. On the program in regions of innovation and entrepreneurship, we have some new initiatives. We're now studying entrepreneurship in Japan. There is a rise of entrepreneurship again in Japan, and particularly a heavy emphasis on women entrepreneurs. There's a large movement of women entrepreneurs in Japan now, and that's very important for countries like Japan because, as I mentioned earlier, in the three ways to get economic growth, Japan now has to depend upon innovation and entrepreneurship, the third way, and so that's an interesting study. We have an activity which we call China 2.0, which is looking at China in the mobile industry and the activities in the mobile and the mobile content, those areas. We just held a workshop on that about 3 weeks ago. And then about a month and a half ago, we had a workshop on green cities with a heavy emphasis on the developments in both Taiwan and mainland China. We're also looking at, we have not yet developed the project in Brazil. We want to extend our studies outside of Asia. Brazil is a very active country right now, and they have a lot of local entrepreneurship in Brazil. We want to get a better grip on that, better understanding of that, and so that's the study that we're in the process of putting together. We haven't got it put together entirely yet, but I think we will. So we're taking new initiatives to expand in different areas from the ones that we've studied in the past.
So who would you say are the main consumers of all of this research?
We have, again, it's a bit of all of the above, but I would say mostly it is government people, academics, planners, university people, some of the business people, associations, for example, venture capital associations, those are the ones who are interested in it.
So can you tell us more about your work as chairman and founder of NanoStellar Incorporated and what you hope to achieve?
Well, NanoStellar is a company that designs, it's a materials design company, and our first line of products is the catalyst for catalytic converters, and we're focusing on catalytic converters for diesel engines. That's a heavier market, a lot more gasoline engines, but the diesel engines require more catalyst, and so we're focused on that. We also are working on some other areas, but at the present we're licensing companies, automotive companies in Europe where there's heavy use of diesel engines for automobiles. More than half of the automobiles in Europe use diesel engines. So we're licensing companies there for the use of this technology and its development to meet the Euro 5 standards, and then we're beginning work for the next set of standards, which will be called the Euro 6 standards. And then we're also working on developing products for heavy-duty diesel for trucks, for example, and off-road vehicles. Those need a slightly different kind of catalyst, and we're working on that. And then we're extending our rational design methodology, which is the core of the company, to work on other areas outside the catalyst area or outside the automotive catalyst area, to look at catalysts, for example, in the reformation of synthetic gases into fuels. And so we're able to extend it. What I think we have been able to demonstrate is the value of our rational design process. A rational design process involves a lot of computational modeling coupled tightly with the synthesis method. So our team of experimentalists and our team of computational people work very closely together and build the models using the two, both the modeling knowledge as well as the synthesis knowledge to help design these products. And we're able to design these products in very short time compared to the more experimental methods that have been prominent in the past.
So what's your exit strategy in terms of this company?
Well, we never talk about exit strategies because I never like to talk about exit strategies simply because you keep doing the same thing no matter what your exit might be. If you think you're going to be acquired or you think you're going to do an IPO, you have to keep doing the same thing. You have to build a company. You have to build it so that it's considered a viable company. And the people who might want to acquire it, or if you're in a position to do an IPO, you have to have about the same qualities for the company. So we don't particularly design an exit strategy. We keep building on the company.
So what can you tell us about your work as chairman and founder of Lumenet Incorporated, and what are your targets?
Now, Lumenet is a different company. It's a lighting company, interesting company. We have an older technology that was designed for another purpose, which we've now redesigned. It's used for general lighting. This technology is a thin, flat, fluorescent light. We can make it in panels. We have just developed, we haven't put on the market yet, but we just developed some screw-in bulbs that would be fitting in the normal bulb sockets. We also, prior to that, had the flat panels that could be used as wall sconces and hallway lights, ceiling lights, and so forth. Our technology has several advantages. One, it has about the same efficacy as LEDs, which a lot of people are focused on, and LEDs have a lot of important application. But we're a lot cheaper than LEDs. We're several times cheaper than LEDs. And we also are dimmable. We can, and that's very big for building management people. We can get different colors by putting different phosphors in the tubes that we use. So there's several advantages, and we see this as providing an alternative, a lower cost alternative to lighting, lower cost than the LEDs to lighting for both commercial and residential homes.
In this sort of process of these companies and others that you're involved with, have you sought venture funding?
Yes, we have venture funding in both of these companies, and we usually, the usual pattern is we start out with some angel money, and I guess that's often been my role, to raise the angel money to get the companies going, and then we seek venture funding from various venture capital groups, the institutional venture funding, and we have in both of these companies, and I think almost all the others. There's one company that I'm involved with that is just getting started. It's still operating on angel money, but all the others have had some degree of institutional investment in them.
So, Bill, I know that you have this great history, and I know that you've been engaged with U.S. presidents in the past. Can you profile some of this work with, meeting and engaging with U.S. presidents? And then what are your views right now on the current political situation?
Well, those are big, tough questions. I have met quite a number of the U.S. presidents. I sometimes have to qualify that when I've occasionally said that I met Franklin Roosevelt, but I do have to qualify that. He came to my hometown to dedicate a memorial, the George Rogers Clark Memorial, when I was a little kid, and I was on the front row of the children who got to say, "Good morning, Mr. President." So that was my meeting with Franklin Roosevelt. It wasn't a very intimate meeting. And then I saw Harry Truman at a whistle stop, and I saw President Eisenhower across the room. But starting with Kennedy, I was able to have time to speak with him on a few occasions. The presidents that I saw most, incidentally, were Nixon and Clinton, and I have not met the current President Obama, nor did I meet George W. Bush. I met his father, George Herbert Walker Bush, and President Reagan. I spent time with President Reagan. Of course, President Reagan was the governor of California and before he became president, and he was also an honorary fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, so I'd occasionally see him there. And then he had appointed me to the National Science Board, so I was occasionally called into the White House to talk science with the president a few times during my 6 years as a member of the National Science Board. They were all very interesting people. I found that, strangely enough, people often criticize Nixon, which including me, because he seemed to have this paranoia streak, as people would say. But he was a very engaging person. When you spoke with him, he engaged you personally. You could tell that he was talking right to you. He wasn't talking to some other audience. And the same was true for Clinton, very engaging in that regard. I think there are certain things that make good leaders. One of the things, and the role of being president is increasingly more demanding. It's far more demanding than it was, 100 years ago, or maybe even 50 years ago. But it's very demanding, and you can see it if you notice that they usually change, their hair gets white during their term of office and so forth, so they're under great pressure. But one of the reasons it is so demanding is because there are many events over which they have little control. And one of the great features of leadership understanding is understanding those world events over which you may not have control and how to deal with those and being ready to deal with those.
I see. You have Obama who has an academic background. And so what are your views about that? And if you were to give him some advice, what would you suggest?
Well, I wouldn't try to give advice to somebody who's been elected president because they've gone through something that I've never had to go through. And so they're probably a lot smarter than me, so I'd be hesitant to give them advice. I think that he's a very quick study, and so my hope is that he's a quick enough study to be able to deal with these problems that he didn't expect to have to deal with when he became president.
Now, you also have a pretty remarkable history in China and with China's leaders. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I started going to China in 1976. I was there in October, just 4 days after the arrest of John Jing and the Gang of Four. It was a very interesting time because there were great demonstrations on the street. The Communist Party has always been concerned about uprisings and change. They were not sure that they would survive the death of Mao. And so they organized all these demonstrations to support the Communist Party when the new General Secretary, Wang Guofeng, was coming into office. And we were there during those various demonstrations. I went there with a purpose to negotiate an exchange to bring students from Stanford, from China, from the People's Republic of China to Stanford. But everything was in an uproar. It was too difficult in October 1976. So I went back in March of 1978 and was able to negotiate an exchange bringing students from China to Stanford as the first students brought to the United States, and we brought them to Stanford. There were eight of them. These were all graduate students. They did extremely well. They all returned to China to very good positions. So that was the beginning of our Stanford program. We now have almost 400 students from China, so it's become, in fact, China has the largest number of international students at Stanford of any country. Of course, being a big country, that's, I guess, not a great surprise. Then in 1979, I met a man named Ma Hong. Ma Hong was a famous economist. He was the president of the Development Research Center for the State Council in China. Wonderful man, became good friends. He and I organized the first international conference held in China. We held it in Hangzhou in 1981. And he and I continued to interact over the years, and he introduced me to many of the leaders in China. For example, he introduced me to Zhao Xiang when he was general secretary and premier. He introduced me to Li Peng. He introduced me to Zhu Rongji. I met many of those important leaders during that time. And I also met Jiang Zemin. I met him when he was mayor of Shanghai. Then I met him when he was in Beijing. So I met a large number of those leaders. It was a very interesting time for me to see their changes. And I thought the transitions then that went on when Wagyu Feng came in, and later, all those transitions were actually peaceful transitions, which was a great credit to the country.
So how's your Mandarin today?
Non-existent, I'm sorry to say. All those years, I've never learned to speak Mandarin. I picked up a few words. I was once proud about being able to get myself across town in a taxi cab, but that was the extent of my Chinese.
Now, I know you were at the Shanghai World Expo. Can you share some of your experiences?
Yes, I had a very interesting recent trip. I went to Changsha, the capital of the Hunan province in Mao's birthplace, where I spoke with high school students about college education, and in particular they were interested in college education in the United States. And that was very interesting. That was independent of the expo. Then I went from there to Wuxi, where there were some forums being held that were connected to the expo. They held a number of the forums outside of Shanghai itself, and these were being held at Wuxi. And these were on a couple things. One of them was on education. The other was really on local economic development, the very kind of thing that I guess people think I'm specialized in and know something about. That was very interesting forum. Then I went from there to the Shanghai Expo. I didn't have a lot of time at the Expo, but I went to a number of the pavilions. I was impressed by the huge number of the crowds. My goodness, I was told that there, on a normal day, there are 300,000 people attend the Expo, and on a Chinese holiday, it's up to 500,000 people. And the fact that they keep those crowds moving and keep them going was really quite interesting. There's a lot of historical things being shown, but the emphasis was on the kind of the motto is better city, better life, and the emphasis is on improving the life of the city. So there was showing the progress of that, of course, was important. One of the things that struck me, of course, I went to Shanghai in 1976 also, the enormous change in Shanghai. The old Shanghai is pretty much gone, except in a few neighborhoods that preserve the old town. And the Bund is still preserved more or less the way it was, been renovated but in the old style. But you don't see much of the old China anymore.
You know, in your speaking engagement to the students, was there one particular question that stood out?
Yes, there was it's very interesting you asked that. The most important question to them, one of the important questions they asked was, will we adjust? They seemed to be concerned that they wouldn't be able to adjust well to the U.S. environment. My answer was that at least the Chinese students that I've seen adjust very quickly. The ones at Stanford seem to adjust quickly. I went to Purdue University and I visit there a lot. They have a large number of Chinese students and they seem to adjust very quickly. So I think they do adjust quickly, but as young people, these are high school students, that was one of their concerns. Could they adjust socially? Not so much could they adjust academically, but could they adjust socially? And I thought that was interesting, and my view is that they do adjust very quickly.
So maybe we can sort of replicate that questions from the forums at the World Expo. What were the best questions at those forums?
I'm sorry, now, what were the best questions at the forum?
Yes, that's correct.
At the ones that we held in Wuxi, I would suppose there were a lot of questions about evaluation of science work because I think they're very concerned about meeting world standards, and so there were those kind of questions about the work of the scientists. I think there were questions about on the education side. Particularly about how universities need to transform themselves and what are the structural changes that need to take place. I spoke about that quite a bit because I think that, in the United States we have no Minister of Education, and in most countries there is a Minister of Education. The Minister of Education plays a very significant role with the universities, whereas here in the United States there is no one playing that role. So there's a lot more independent freedom of action on the part of the institutions. in many countries, the practice is that the president of the university is appointed for a fixed term. In this country, I think that's very rare. In fact, I don't know of any institutions for which that's done, but they may exist. But most universities in this country, the presidents are appointed for an indefinite term, serving at the pleasure of the board of trustees or the regents, as the case may be. I think when presidents are appointed for a fixed term, there's much less incentive to innovate. It takes a long time to change an institution. If you're only appointed for 4 years, you may not get it done in that period of time. So I think that reduces the incentive for innovation. Another important difference is the way in which the research of young faculty members is supported. In many countries, the money is distributed to the institution and then down to the senior professors, and the senior professors then hire or support the junior professors in their research. That puts the junior professor under a great deal of obligation to the senior professor. In this country, junior professors very quickly apply for their own research independent of the other faculty. And so they have this independence and the freedom of action, which I think is important for innovation. So I think those are structural changes that are important. And I see some movement in that direction, but I don't see a lot of movement in that direction yet. And there's a lot of discussion about those issues at these forums.
So what's your assessment then of India?
Well, I'm less informed about India. I was going to India in the early 90s. I have not been back for more than 10 years now. I think that India is obviously very dynamic, as is China. We see a lot of new design centers arising there. I think they've become very good at some quite advanced IT technology in particular, and I don't know about the other areas. So I don't have a strong assessment of India, but all the external parameters indicate that they're doing very well and will continue to do well in this high-tech economy.
You know, Bill, I'm always amazed at your heavy schedule and just how hard you work. And I know you did several presentations this year worldwide. Can you maybe overview some of the key messages in your presentations and maybe even share some stories from these events?
Well, I don't know that I have a lot to say on that. I do a lot of presentations at different places in the world. And what I find, from my viewpoint, interesting is there are certain commonalities of attitudes, and then there are differences. And trying to understand the distinction between those which are very common and those which are different. You will see, for example, in Malaysia, that there's the universities are not as well developed, although they're developing rapidly now and trying to become much more international. But you see the young people in all these places are seeking opportunity to be independent and so forth. I think that's a very healthy sort of thing. Recently, in May, I was at the World Islamic Economic Forum in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia. The World Islamic Economic Forum has been functioning now for 6 years. This is the sixth year of the forum, and it's focused on the economic issues. Of the 3 days of that forum, one whole day was devoted to women and youth. And I thought that was really very interesting because of women in business, women's education in the Islamic world. And so there's a lot of attention being given to modern education, what has to be developed to give Islamic women in today's world a modern education. So there's an awakening there, which I found really quite inspiring, that this kind of thing is happening. Of course, progress will perhaps be slow, but it's moving in the right direction. I thought that was interesting, and it may be one of the next big interesting movements in the world.
I think it'd be interesting to have a camera crew follow you during all of your travels for a year.
Yeah, well, I do get a lot of people taking my picture. When young people come up and want to have their picture taken with me, so I accommodate that a lot.
You know, Bill, I know that you received the David Packard Civic Entrepreneur Award in 2008. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, that's an award given by the Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network and the Packard Family Foundation to recognize people who, as they put it, carry on the spirit of David Packard. It's for work in civic entrepreneurship, or sometimes people refer to it as social entrepreneurship. It's devoted to helping build the civic society, the civic community. I did a lot of work with nonprofits. I've served on the board and helped start as many nonprofits as I have for-profits quite actively, including Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network. I was on the first board of directors of that and selected their first president on the committee that selected their first president. So I've been very active in those areas. I've always felt that nonprofits had an important role in society. They could be a bridge. They could take on issues that companies might not be able to take on because companies have shareholders to whom they owe a certain allegiance and certain they have to get a return for them. The nonprofits do not. So they can play an extremely important role. And I suppose it was largely for that activity that I was receiving the Packard Award. No one person could embody the full spirit of David Packard. He was very big on community development. People often don't realize how much he did for the community as well as for his company. I recall him one time saying that there are four things important for his company. And the first three any business school student can name: you must pay attention to your employees, you must pay attention to your shareholders, you must pay attention to your customers. But David said you also must pay attention to your community. So he's very big on this issue of community development. He organized what was, I think, called the Silicon Valley Manufacturing Association, now has a different name, and one of the leadership groups. He helped organize that. He's very big. So it'd be very hard for any one person to replicate all that David Packard did. But combined, if people all work together on it, they can affect similar things. And so my message was, by working together, we can all combine and achieve the kind of the spirit of David Packard.
You know, you brought up nonprofits, and a real challenge often for nonprofits is funding. So what are your recommendations on that front?
Well, it is a challenge for nonprofits, and there are many nonprofits, like for-profits, that probably should not exist. I mean, there are a lot of for-profits that fail and shouldn't exist, and they're the same is probably true for nonprofits. Some people start them with the idea they have a great social idea and they're very socially minded people, but they don't think about it as a business. One of the organizations that I helped start was called the Center for Excellence in Nonprofit, and one of our objectives there was to teach and train the directors of these, executive directors, or the heads of these, as well as their boards of directors, about how to really run them like a business. It's a different kind of business. It's a business with different objectives from a profit-making business, but nonetheless can be run pretty much as a business. And I think that when that's done, people have a lot of confidence in that nonprofit. I remember helping one nonprofit that had been in existence for some time and had no business plan, and they asked me about raising money. And I said, well, you're not going to raise money, any significant amount, if you don't have a business plan. People want to see that money is well used. And I've always had that feeling, if you take other people's money, whether if you're a for-profit organization, you take people's investment money, or if you're a nonprofit organization and you take their charitable contributions, you have an obligation to those people to use that money well. And I think once nonprofits understand that they use it well, then they can develop a plan in which people will have confidence and they can do better with their fundraising.
You've had this, as I mentioned, a remarkable history, and it's just outstanding, with global impact and for many, many years, and continue to do so. Are there any people that you think, wow, they're just really interesting people, and can you name them?
Well, I knew many of these early Silicon Valley leaders like Hewlett and Packard. I thought they were quite remarkable people. And of course, the founders of Varian Associates, I met those. I thought they were really, really outstanding people. It was a great pleasure to be able to know those early founders. And then I was involved in the venture capital business early on. I was had a role in helping start the first Mayfield Fund. I was an advisor to the general partners, and I was a small limited partner in that fund, but my main role is to be advisor to them. I got to meet some of those early venture capital people. Tommy Davis was the principal for the Mayfield Fund. Arthur Rock, of course, who financed Fairchild and then Intel. And then Apple was one of the great venture capitalists of our time. Fitz Johnson, Bill Draper, all of those people were really quite fascinating people. And I had a great opportunity to meet with them, and I really enjoyed my time with them.
I know that Konkuk University in South Korea is or has opened up the William F. Miller School of Management of Technology with you as honorary dean. Can you tell, the audience what led to that?
Well, it's very interesting. It probably gives me more credit than I deserve. As an anecdote, I was at a party for a man who was receiving an honor a few years ago, and as I went down the reception line, I congratulated him, and he said, "Well, I'm not sure I deserve it." And I said, "Well, take them when you get them, because there are many times you deserve credit and you don't get it, so take it whenever you can get it." So that was kind of my attitude here. I think the history of this is I really didn't invent the idea of management technology, but I did put a name on it, and I think sometimes putting a name on it it gives you more credit than you deserve, but it gives you that recognition. When I was provost at Stanford for 9 years or 8.5 years as provost, at the end of that time, I was not doing real science anymore. I wasn't even doing computer science or physics. I had an appointment in the physics faculty at SLAC as well as in the computer science department. So I was invited to go into the business school to introduce the technology courses in the business school, because at that time, that was 1979, in the Stanford Business School, the only technology course they had was how to use a computer for people who wanted to learn and make use of the computer. So I began to introduce courses, and I introduced a course called Technology Management. One of the professors in the Stanford Business School, Gayton Germain, who now has passed away, organized a book called The Executive Course, which was intended to be a little MBA all in one book with different chapters on different subjects that would be taught in business schools. And he asked me to do the one on technology, so I entitled that chapter Technology Management. Well, this got picked up in Korea, and there was a report written in Korea about the ideas and importance of technology management. And what it is, technology management brings together the best of industrial engineering and engineering practices with the best of business practices. This is what it basically brings together. And the reason that was important, particularly in the Asian schools, is their schools of engineering did not teach any management. They had no management course, whereas here in the U.S., the schools of engineering have taught industrial engineering and other aspects of engineering management for some time. So the Korean school is not doing that. And with their business schools not teaching much about technology, there was this feeling that they need to have programs that bridge that. And those are the programs of management of technology. So this Konkuk University apparently picked up on this notion that I was kind of the godfather, I suppose, of that subject matter. And the president of the university, a very distinguished man, President Oh, who got his PhD at Stony Brook, and the vice president, Mr. Kim, who got his PhD at Johns Hopkins, both had strong U.S. educational backgrounds. And Dr. Oh, had been also a minister of science and technology in Korea, and I got to know him during that time. So they decided they wanted to start this new school on management of technology, and they asked me in 2009 if they could name it after me. So I felt very honored if they were willing to do that, which they did.
That's just such a fascinating story, and it just, again, speaks to your remarkable background. Now, you know, you have this, as I mentioned, amazing history. Are there some lessons that you can pass on from all of your roles?
Well, I think there's certain lessons that people learn over time. I suppose one of the most important lessons that I had to learn was how to deal with the unexpected. I think many people have their own agenda, and they want to accomplish certain things. But in World War II, I was a field artillery officer in World War II. I was not in combat. I got to Europe after the war had ended, and I was assigned to work with the military government. But I had the training. I had the military training and the officer's training. And one of the things that you do, a lot of the training is spent on how to deal with confusion in the battlefield. And then the other part is leadership. Those are somewhat coupled together. So dealing with the unexpected and willing to deal with it, recognizing right away when it's important, jumping on it, I think is one of the important lessons that I've learned over time.
What do you consider to be your top contributions?
That's a very difficult one. I sometimes jokingly say that they're still to come. They're still in front of me. No, that's probably not the case. I think understanding the processes of technology development, and that comes to the core of this idea of technology management, I think being able to bring that together. I made something of a specialty of not being specialized, at understanding breadth, and I recall writing a paper on leadership of technological, I think I said intellectual institutions, but by that I meant institutions whose main product was knowledge and not some product. That would include universities, research institutes, high-tech companies that are design companies. Certainly NanoCell would be one of those where our real product is this rational design process and so forth. Those are the kind of organizations I was talking about. And I think understanding what it takes to drive those and organize those is important. And I often make the point that leadership and management are not separable. You often hear people talk about leadership, and then you hear people talk about management. I don't think those are really separable. If you have management without leadership, it is sterile. But if you have leadership without management, it's impotent. Nothing gets done. So you need both of those. And I recall writing a paper about that. And there were four things which I thought were really important in managing those kind of institutions. One was having a world view, understanding what was happening in the world, to understand the forces out there that might affect you in some way, and be willing to respond to those. The second was understanding your institution. I describe as understanding the soul of your institution. What are the closely held values of the people working in that institution? What do they expect? Even if you disagree with them and you want to change them, you have to understand those values and what's driving them to be able to do that. The third was really having a shared vision, to be able to create for these people a vision, to show them how following that vision be beneficial to them. It's really working down to the individual. And the last is the will to act, and to have the will to act. And that will to act has to permeate the whole organization, not just the leader, but all through the whole organization. You have to empower people to act. And so those are some of the things that I think I have been able to understand and then contribute to others as I've mentored young CEOs and taught students. I try to teach those values.
In your prior roles, what were the most difficult challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time, and what would you do differently now?
Well, I probably did not get to do everything I wanted to do. I probably had, as we used to say in the Midwest, my eyes were bigger than my stomach or something, that I had ambition to do more things than I could do, and having to prioritize those was always painful because I wanted to do them all. And I did have to prioritize them because I really realized that I couldn't do them all. I don't know what I would do differently. It's hard for me to imagine that. I suppose I might have brought in more artistic things earlier in my life. I did not spend a lot of time on artistic things early on. I really believe use of the right brain, so to speak, is really quite important. And over the later years, I began to do more of that. I think that that appreciation, and I always enjoyed artistic things, but I didn't try to participate in it. And I think I would have done that more early on in life.
Now, considering your history and just the tremendous kind of scope that you have worldwide, I was wondering if you can make your top predictions of future trends and their implications and opportunities.
Well, I think one of the trends that we see underway, which is far from complete, is all the emphasis on mobility of information. I recall an article in The Economist magazine about 5 years ago, which said that the digital divide would be bridged by the cell phone, not by the PC. And that struck me, of course, that the cell phone is the most ubiquitous IT device in the world, overwhelmingly, by all measures. And I thought, my goodness, of course, we should put everything on the mobile. So I think that movement is far from complete, and actually building out the bandwidth, the wireless bandwidth, to be able to achieve a lot of that will be important. So there are many dimensions of that which are happening. The other thing which is in some ways in the unpredictable is how rapidly the value point in a supply chain shifts. And by that I mean where the most money is made at the different places along the supply chain changes over time. Innovations in one area may make that the most important area. A few years ago, the most important part in the mobile industry were the device makers, the people, the Nokias, the Ericssons, the NTTs, the Samsungs. They were the most important. Now the most important people are the people who are providing access to content, the Apples, the Googles, and so forth. That shifted very quickly, and preparing for that shift and trying to anticipate it, I think, is really very big. But I think we will see this building out of the mobile as something very big. I also think we're going to see big concerns about what that means socially. And you see these studies coming up about the social impact of that. Is it changing how we relate to people? Those are important studies that I think the studies of a man and technology. There's a wonderful book written many years ago by a man named Gordon Child. It's called Man Makes Himself. Gordon Child started writing before World War II and continued after that, and then died not too long after World War II. But his book was about how man invents a technology for a purpose, and then finds other purposes of that, and then the technology develops. And so society and technology go back and forth with these developments. And I thought it was a wonderful concept, and I've sort of held to that concept. So I think as the mobile builds out, then how we adapt to it and the social aspect of that will also become very important. In terms of global trends, of course, China will be a major player in the world, is a major player in the world, will continue to be a major player in the world for a long time. And I think that's changing a lot of the economic dynamics in Asia, and it'll change a lot of the economic dynamics in the world. I think that it's too early to see whether the Islamic world will come together and develop, but I have high hopes for that. And if that happens, then I think there's an awareness of the leaders that they have to take a new tack. And if that happens, you'll see a lot of dynamism there that is untapped. at the present time. So that's a possible trend. I don't know that I would predict it yet, but I think it's likely, because I think I've seen enough of the interest of the leaders of Islamic countries to make these changes that I think that could be a very interesting development.
You know, there's a proliferation of information out there, and, you know, people are bombarded. So what are your top recommended resources and why?
Well, I still read books. I guess I brought up on books. I once jokingly said I engaged in distance learning as a child called books. And the book was, of course, the most important instrument for distance learning ever developed up to now. And now we're developing the e-books, which are back to books again. I think as information proliferates, people will find that the aggregators and the sorters, the people who play the role that editors and newspapers used to play, will become important. Now, people will say, well, there's a danger in that. That means that you're dependent upon the taste and interest of those particular editors. I think that's true. But that was true of newspapers in the early days, too. There are certain standards of what would be published and what wouldn't. And many of those standards were established by the publishers and the editors of those newspapers. But I think because of the proliferation and the difficulty of tracking all the information, that the aggregators, the people who put things into books or put things into larger journals, I think those will be the most interesting source of information.
You know, in your travels, do you have any stories that you can share, perhaps something surprising, unexpected, amazing, or amusing?
Well, some of my more surprising and amusing things have been in my wildlife work. I've been active in wildlife conservation for many years, starting working with wolves in Minnesota some 20-some years ago, and then in Africa. I help support some projects, and I've found some surprising things there. I'm always interested in watching animal behavior. One of the things I learned from it is that the extent to which animals read body language and sounds and very, very acutely, and I began to realize that we do too as people. We do that as one of the learning. But I have in Namibia, I have a cheetah friend. This is one of the projects dedicated to preserving cheetahs in the wild in Namibia, but they have some cheetahs that are not releasable. They were taken when their mothers were killed when they were very young, and so they have habituated and have really related to the humans. This cheetah recognizes my voice or my smell, I'm not sure what, when I arrive, and he comes up and wants me to scratch his head, so it's kind of fun to have that happen, that kind of interaction.
You know, you talk about people, you know, picking up body cues or maybe, you know, subliminally in some ways. So what's going to happen as people continue to interact virtually on the Internet?
Yes, I think they'll miss some of that. We communicate a lot just in our voice, and I think people will miss some of that. I think we will find that people are enamored with the remote and Internet kind of communication, but I think you still see a large desire for people to interact with other individuals. I don't think I see that going away. I'm just reminded of when I spoke earlier about the question that these young Chinese high school students were asking, will we be able to adjust? What they're really asking is the social question of how they will interact with people and so forth, because that was really important to them, high on their agenda. And I think that will continue to be high on our agenda, and frankly, I think that's a good thing.
I have this unique opportunity to drill into the accumulated wisdom from an accomplished international executive, innovator, researcher, thought leader. So if you could sum up your life experiences with career tips for the ICT professional, what would be your tips and the reasons behind them?
Well, I think for me, the most important thing, it may not be important for everybody, but for me, the most important thing is to get some breadth of understanding, not to focus too narrowly. I started out as a classics student, and then I moved from classics to mathematics, and then I settled on physics. But I thought that breadth is important. And Peter Drucker used to say the best training for an entrepreneur is to study classics, to get a breadth of understanding, to get the right brain working. And I mentioned earlier, if anything I would have done differently, I'd have got the right brain working more earlier in the game than I did. And I think that is really important. Perseverance, of course, is important. It's hard work, but hard work can be a lot of fun. Like athletes work very hard and they put themselves through a lot of pain, but they enjoy it. There's a lot of fun. And I think the same can be true in any professional job. And then be prepared for the unexpected.
What are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession like medicine, law, and so on, would demonstrate professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, and recognized credentials?
But I think a lot of that has developed. I think there are accepted codes of ethics. You're always going to see some outliers. You see the hackers and so forth who are outside, but you'll see people outside in any profession. But I think the majority of people understand that there's a certain responsibility to the people you're working with. And I think that computing is a profession that permits you to go in many different directions. There are so many different areas of application that are increasing, in fact, that I think it's a wonderful profession from that viewpoint.
You know, Bill, who had the greatest impact on your life? As you look back and reflect, you know, who really sort of, you know, they were so important to you personally?
Well, obviously my parents had a substantial impact, and my sister, who passed away at a fairly young age, had a big impact. Among my teachers, I would say I learned a lot from books. There are certain books that I read a lot, but in terms of my parents, I was born on a farm, and later I realized what good things my father had done for me. When I grew old enough, I had to work for him. He said, well, you know, you have to work for me after school, weekends, summers, and I'm not going to pay you, but here's 5 acres, and you grow something, and you sell it, and that's your payment. So I had to learn to grow and sell things that I could sell in the summertime when I had the time to raise things. I raised produce, vegetables and stuff. So that was important. But the other thing he did, which was equally important, he would not give me chores, but he would give me tasks. He would give me projects. He would say, this summer you take care of the orchard. Here are the books you learn, when you trim, when you spray, all those things about the orchard. Next year, it'd be you take care of the hay crops. So he gave me these chores. I had to become a little project leader. I mean, it was a tiny project, of course, but I had to learn the process of managing a project, and I thought that was important. My mother was the academic. She was the college professor at a small university in Indiana, and she was kind of the driver for it. I recall, friend saying to me not long ago that she thought I was like a little boy up on the high dive about to take a dive and look down at his mother and say, hey, Mommy, Mommy, look at me. And I said, yes, and I think down there would be my mother saying, Bill, there's one higher, go higher, Bill, go higher.
Wow, those are really interesting. I also know that you've mentored students. Is there any particular students that come to mind that, you know, where you still have a long relationship or you've had a long relationship?
Well, I've had a fairly long relationship with a few of them that I keep contact with, and they come every once in a while. One that I've not had contact with pops in to see me also. I've also had a large number of international students. I ran a program for Korean entrepreneurs, where I had about 250 Korean entrepreneurs over a 5-year period of time. So I had a lot of Korean students. And when I go to Korea, I usually meet with them, a few of them, I meet with them and continue to have that contact.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking, are there any questions I should have asked you? And if so, what are they? And then what would be your answers?
Well, I think you had asked me about my worldview, and you have already asked me about that worldview. I think that is important. I think you might ask, might have asked questions about leadership. I've already made some comments about that, some of the essential qualities of leadership, and the fact that leadership and management have to go together. I think real leadership is demonstrated when people step up to the unexpected. For change to occur, someone has to step outside their normal role. If people just continue to play their normal role, you don't get any change. So someone has to step outside the normal role. That's when you see real leadership, when people do that. And that's what Dave Packard did. He stepped out. He wasn't just the manager and development of Hewlett-Packard. He was the manager of development of the community. He worked with government. He was the Deputy Secretary of Defense for a period of time. He stepped outside his normal role. And that's, I think, when you see real leadership occurring.
Well, that's fascinating. And I should sort of remind the audience that we, you know, there was an interview with Bill a couple of years ago, and Bill talks extensively about sort of the management side within that interview, giving all sorts of sort of best practices and so on. So I'll provide a link when this interview is published to that prior interview. You know, Bill, we're at the end of this session today, and I really do thank you. You know, we will continue to follow your very significant global and historical contributions, and, you know, we really do appreciate that you took this time to share your considerable wisdom with our audience.
Well, Steve, and it was a great pleasure to do that. I think the most important thing I've done is keep going. I'm going to have my 85th birthday in November, and I'm still helping run companies and running around the world lecturing and help co-directing a program at Stanford. But I also have plenty of time for leisure activities, and I suppose when you asked me about important things, I would say that was also important. I was a dedicated vacation taker. I always took time for my vacation. I'm still doing that. So it's my pleasure to speak with you today, and good luck with your program.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. William F. Miller, the world premier authority and visionary on business strategy, innovation, technology, entrepreneurship, industrial development, and international thought leadership.